So I've got Dr. Glenn Livingston here, the author of Never Binge Again. So Glenn, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and just give us a little bit about who you are and what Never Binge Again is.
So I'm a clinical psychologist by training from a family of 17 psychotherapists and psychologists. And if people asked anything, if something broke in the house, people knew how to ask it how it feel, but nobody knew how to fix it. And I also am a former very serious binge eater. I had a very serious problem for about 25 years. And I went about trying to solve it in what I view as the wrong way now, where I had the paradigm, because I'm a psychologist, because of my upbringing, I had the paradigm in my head that I'd be able to love myself thin. There must be some hole in my heart, and if I could figure out what that metaphorical hole was, then I wouldn't have to keep trying to fill the hole in my stomach. And I went to psychologists and psychiatrists and nutritionists and therapists and 12-step groups and eating disorder specialists. And it was a very spiritual, deep, insightful journey, and I don't regret taking it. But it didn't really help me with the eating. I'd get a little thinner and a lot heavier. I'd be a little less obsessed with food and then a lot more obsessed with food. And it wasn't until I reached almost 300 pounds, I stopped weighing myself around 257, but I'm pretty sure I was getting close to 300, maybe 280, who knows? And my triglycerides were over 1,000, and the doctors were yelling at me all the time. And that I really started to look at alternatives. And there were a couple of things that led me to look at alternative approaches to eating disorders. One was that because I was married to a woman who traveled for business, I had a lot of time on my hands and I started a dual career. And I did a lot of consulting for big food and big pharma. I was really on the wrong side of the war now that I look back on it. But I did a lot of consulting for big food in particular. And I saw that they were spending millions, if not billions, of dollars to engineer these hyper palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and excitotoxins and salt. And it was all designed to hit the bliss point in the reptilian brain without giving us enough nutrition to feel satisfied. If you think of the brain as having really three parts, and I'm not a neurologist or a medical doctor, so someone could take me to task on this a little bit, but basically, there's the real reptilian brain, which we think came first, and that's the most primitive part of us. And when it looks at something in the environment, it says, "Do I eat it? Do I mate with it, or do I kill it?" It's like a bad college drinking game. It's not until the mammalian brain shows up and says, "Wait a minute, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is it going to have on the people that you love, on your tribe, on your, emotional connections?" If the noise gets real, if the highway gets loud in the background, I'll close the window, but it's nice to have the fresh air. And it's the neocortex, or the think of thing that we think of as more uniquely human, that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is it going to have on your long-term goals, on the kind of person you're trying to be, on your character, and your contribution to society, and your music, and your art, and your broader relationships, and your work, and your humanity. And so the part of the brain that seems to be responding to binge eating is the reptilian brain, and it has nothing to do with love. And so I'm spending 25 years on this deep journey trying to figure out, how do I love myself thin? How do I heal my inner wounded child by loving it more? And maybe that's going to fix me. But really, binge eating is an erroneous activation of the feast and famine cycle. It's this part of the brain that says, wait a minute, if we live in an environment where calories are and nutrition are not readily available than all of a sudden they are. And with all of these concoctions available today, they're readily available, you know, so quickly. And people diet like crazy to try to stay away from them, and then they overindulge in them. Then that reptilian brain is overactive. It's overfiring. And every time it does, there's some fat cat in a white suit with a mustache laughing all the way to the bank, right? These corporations know what they're doing. And I could wax eloquent about some of the things that they do and some of the things I saw. And the advertising industry also knows how to push your buttons. You know, they, I remember working with a food bar manufacturer who the VP, as he was leaving the company, kind of hung his head in shame and told me that their most profitable insight was taking the vitamins out of the bar and putting the money into the packaging instead. And they created these vibrant, multicolored packages, which in nature would signal the availability of a diversity of micronutrients. You know, when we're told to eat the rainbow, find deep green lettuce and yellow carrots and, you know, blueberries and red tomatoes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's because when you eat the rainbow, you're getting a diversity of micronutrients. So our evolutionary brains are set up to respond to that. But they were faking us out. And so these are just some very powerful forces that are creating this habit that might not have anything to do with my personal history and, you know, that my mama didn't love me enough when I was a little boy and my, you know, I was in a bad marriage and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I was looking at this alternative addiction treatment model called Rational Recovery. And this guy works with alcoholics and drug addicts for the most part, where he deals with substances that you can completely quit, as opposed to food where you have to take the lion out of the cage three times a day and walk it around the block. And he really talked about isolating the thoughts that originated from this misfiring of the reptilian brain and taking more of an alpha wolf approach, like an approach of dominance, seeing it like a bodily organ, but kind of the way that an alpha wolf would see a lesser wolf in the pack challenging for leadership. And when an alpha wolf is challenged for leadership, it doesn't go, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. It growls and it snarls and it says, get back in line or I'll kill you. Like it asserts its dominance. And if you look at the parallels in the human being, if you're going to think of our own bodies as a little ecosystem that's got its own urges that have to be managed, we're not without parallel there with regards to bodily impulses that we control. So for example, if I really had to pee very badly right now, if my bladder was saying, Glenn, you really got to go, I would gently tell it that, look, gently but assertively tell it that, look, I'm in charge. I'm doing this interview with Eleanor. And when I'm done, then we'll go and take care of it. I would take care of my authentic bodily need, but I wouldn't let it control me. The same thing with your reproductive organs. If you see someone attractive on the street, you don't just run out and kiss them. You know, there are very established civilized protocols for going about those things, or, you know, I'm kind of shy, so don't do it.
I don't think too many people have the absolute confidence to just go kissing strangers. Yeah.
Right. But the point is that it's part of a civilized society where we're expected to control those impulses that are generated from our own body. So why can't we do it with food? You know, so here we have this bodily organ. You know, and you can localize specific parts of the brain that seem to generate those impulses. And you have this bodily organ that's saying, eat, you know, you got to eat. You're going to die if you don't have this. But it's just a physical urge. And we seem to have the ability to manage any physical urge. So why can't I be assertive like that? So I did this crazy thing, and I was never going to publish this. This was just to solve my own eating problem. I was a child and family psychologist by training, so I wasn't really working with eating disorders. I used to refer them to specialists. And I decided that I was going to draw very clear lines in the sand so that I knew when the reptilian brain was active. So for example, I said, I will never have chocolate on a weekday again. And then if I heard a little voice in my head that said, go ahead, Glenn, you know, that chocolate bar at the counter at Starbucks which has your name on it, it's really okay to have that because you worked out hard enough, even though it's a Wednesday, you're not going to gain any weight and it's just as easy to start tomorrow. I would say, wait a minute, that's not me. I called it my inner pig. I wish I called it something else. And I wish that I knew to change that name before I published the book, but that's what I published it as. And it got really, really popular. But I'd say that's not me, that's my inner pig. My inner pig is squealing for pig slop. Chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And it was just this mechanism that heightened my awareness at the moment of impulse to remind me of the original plans that I set and kind of to get me out of that reptilian brain emergency state so that I could examine the thought and make a better decision. And I didn't get fixed immediately. It wasn't a miracle, except I no longer felt powerless and confused. Up until that point, I felt like there was some mysterious force inside of me, and it was like it could take me hostage and hold a gun to my head and say, you know, sit down by the refrigerator and go to town. And I no longer felt like that. I felt like they were conscious choices. And slowly but surely, I would keep a journal about what my pig was saying, and I would look for the logical fallacies and what it was saying. For example, when it says that it's just as easy to start tomorrow, that couldn't be further from the truth. The way the brain works, these are the principles of neuroplasticity. When you have a craving and you reinforce the craving by eating it, it's going to be stronger tomorrow. So the truth is that if you're in a hole, you have to start digging. You can only ever use the present moment to be healthy. So there were countless examples of things my pig would say that would squeal about, and countless examples of how I figured out that it was wrong. And then on top of that, I realized that it worked a little better if I put the squeals in writing, if I put the pig's voice in writing. And I think that's because writing is an upper brain activity and, you know, and binging is a lower brain activity. So I think that further worked to solidify the activation of the upper brain over the lower brain. And then I learned some breathing exercises. We do what we call 7-11 breaths, where you breathe in for seven and out for a count of 11. And that seems to work because, you know, in the wild, if there was really a state of emergency, if you were being chased by a hungry bear, for example, you wouldn't have time to breathe out for longer than you breathed in. You'd be gulping for air as much as you can so you could run as fast as you could. And so when you're breathing out for longer than you breathe in, you're signaling the brain that this is not an emergency. And so that takes you out of the sympathetic nervous system, like the emergency response system, and into the parasympathetic system, which is the one that says you have time to rest and digest and think and strategize and, you know, use your reason. And over the course of about 8 years, I really worked it out. I got thin, thin-ish. I'm never skinny. I could be if I wanted to now, but I don't like to eat as little as I have to eat in order to be skinny. So.
Yeah, it's an annoying compromise, unfortunately, but sometimes it just really isn't worth it at the end of the day.
Sometimes the juice ain't worth the squeeze, you know? But the point is I make conscious decisions about it. And you know, my triglycerides are back in line and everything else is going well. And then when I got divorced in 2015, when I was getting divorced, I was a minor part of a publishing company and the CEO called me and said he wanted to write a book. He wanted us to write a book so we could do some marketing and prove our worth to more established authors. And so I turned the journal into a book and we published it back then. And it just took off. I mean, it just, we have 1 million readers and 13,000 reviews. And I've since written 6 more books and we have a little boutique coaching agency. And that's now I go around and people don't really recognize me by name, but they recognize my face. And sometimes they'll be in a bookstore and they come up and point at me and they go, pig guy, which
was quite a nickname.
It wasn't the claim to fame I wanted, but that's a little background for you.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. And obviously your coaching program and what you write about in the book is very different to the kind of conventional treatment of binging. And what I'm kind of writing about in my article is about the situation we have here in the UK in terms of services that are there for people with eating disorders. We've got a bit of a crisis here where most people end up on a waiting list for years and years and years unless they have anorexia and have their BMI under 15. But what I think is really interesting about your method is it's so far removed from the kind of general consensus we have in the UK of how to treat these problems. Like you said at the start about kind of trying to love yourself out of the issue, which generally doesn't work. I like personally from my experience, it didn't work.
Right.
And like I did use your program to help me recover, and it's very empowering to not have to do all this background work. Instead, you just get straight to the point, and you don't see immediate success, but you see success much faster than sitting on a waiting list here and being expected to just kind of love yourself better. So that's what I find really interesting about your method is it's so different, but it's so successful as well. And I think it actually empowers people a lot more than the treatment we have here. Because the treatment we have here is you get a guided self-help program, which, by the way, is from a book that was written in the 80s. So it's very outdated compared to the kind of methods you've described, which are very much more in line with Jack Trimpe's Rational Recovery, which was pretty radical at the time. And it also is CBT, and a lot of CBT is kind of, from what I know, is they go a lot into any past trauma the person might have and so on. But my argument here is that actually is, first of all, not enough because it's not actually addressing the problem. Whereas I feel like your method does address the problem. And the reason I'm doing this kind of interview is because I want to give a bit of a perspective on that there are different methods that could be being used, such as your program. Obviously it is like a private thing. It's not on the health service. Obviously in America you guys have privatized health there. Over here we have a
It's not super expensive though.
yeah no it's actually very 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 good for the kind of results it gives and the amount of people it helps. So I suppose my question I wanted to bring here is, what would you say? I mean, obviously you've mentioned about the whole idea of like you can't really love yourself out of this problem. What would you say in general is kind of maybe a bit wrong or lacking in the kind of traditional approaches to treating individuals who might have a binging problem? Would you say it's that kind of trying to love yourself out of it?
I would. Okay, there are a couple of issues underlying what you're asking me. I want, for the sake of legalities, I want people to know we're not offering a treatment. We offer training and education and coaching.
Of course.
And that's because I really wanted to be free to do what I thought was best rather than have to 100% comply with best practices. That said, I had been in contact with Ashley Higgins. I think she's at Immaculata University. And what she does is she gathers the clinical evidence on and experimental evidence on what actually works for eating disorders. And it turns out that for binge eating, what really works is cognitive behavioral therapy and possibly small doses of SSRIs. Medications. And so what we're doing is actually very consistent with, with CBT, where we're isolating the destructive food thoughts from the conscious constructive thought, food thoughts. We're pulling them apart, and then we're rationally disempowering the destructive thoughts. That's a big part of what we offer. And then we help people to learn how to relax and switch nervous systems at the moment the impulse is firing. And the thing that's consistent with traditional eating disorders treatment is that we do believe you have to flood your body with nutrition at a slight caloric deficit if you want to overcome binge eating and lose weight. A big part of the binge eating problem is the restriction problem also. Most binge eaters are also very good dieters, and they live their life like the nursery rhyme, which said, when she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was horrid. So we have that in common with traditional treatments. I think that it's, you know, it's not sexy to tell people what I'm telling people.
Yeah.
So look, you've got a pig inside you. You can separate from this thing. You can take control. Wake up and take control. You've had the power the whole time. Stop abdicating your free will and responsibility. Stop saying you're powerless. The devil made me do it. It's not my fault. I have a disease. See, people don't really want to hear that. I mean, they do when they recognize that they can claim their power back a lot quicker than they ever thought they could. But people are really ashamed of how they, I mean, I take myself. I was, you know, going through 7 different drive-thrus in a day to make sure nobody knew what I was eating. I was eating out of the garbage. I was taking my roommate's food without telling him. Then I'd have to go and buy it and put it back. And, you know, and I was standing there. It was very obvious how heavy I was, so everybody could tell. So there's a lot of shame involved. And so the message that, you know, it's not your fault, you're not responsible, you can't control yourself, this is a mysterious force inside you that no human being can really take control over by themselves, when I think the truth is the opposite. I think that we have to, I mean, it's fine to get support, but you can't tell yourself that you have to have a sponsor you have to talk to every day for the rest of your life, because you're essentially giving yourself the opposite message, that you have to cultivate fear. You've got to be frightened of your own body. You're like a dependent little child. And so I think that the message that there's this overwhelming mysterious force inside of you and you've got a disease is much more palatable to people. It's sexier. It's much easier to sell. It lends itself towards, you know, for the psychotherapy world, longer and more expensive treatments, because it can take years to work through those emotional issues, whereas you could identify the destructive thoughts and disempower them within a couple of months. Mm-hmm. I think that there is another approach that kind of sort of works, which is mindful eating, like mindful and intuitive eating. It kind of sort of works, but there are two problems with it. One is, it only works when you can be mindful. And in today's world, who can be mindful all the time?
It's very, very hard to be mindful all the time. That's the problem. Like, I know mindfulness is brilliant, but if you are a working adult, even someone at school, you don't really have the chance to always be mindful. But I do think, yeah, I do really appreciate the whole thing about mindfulness and intuitive eating. And I'm glad to see actually a lot of people are advocating for that. But like you said, it's very difficult to always be 100% focused on the here and now.
And the other thing is this idea that you should eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full. It only works if your hunger and full meters are accurate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with what big corporations are doing to break your hungry and full meters, I don't think it's really viable if you have any sense of being out of control already. I don't think it's really viable to think you can just teach yourself to heal those hunger and full meters while you're still eating those industrial foods. For example, did you know that when you buy a bag of chips at the convenience store, that the likelihood is that that bag of chips does not come from a unitary conveyor belt? That bag of chips probably comes from 5 or 6 conveyor belts that have microscopic variations in flavor on the different conveyor belts. And the reason that they do it is because on an evolutionary basis, when you sense variation in flavor, you're probably sensing a variation in micronutrients. And so we are hardwired to keep eating when we find something that tastes a little bit different. So these big companies know this stuff, you know, and they monitor your galvanic skin response, and they monitor pupillary dilation, and they monitor heart rate, and like all the different subtle elements of excitation that we're not aware of, and they figure out how to stimulate all that. It's really removing your better judgment. And so my personal opinion is that eating when you're hungry and stopping when you're full is a good idea, if you can work it out, and you should always be trying to do that. And that eating mindfully is a really good idea, and you should always be trying to do that also. But without an adequately functioning hunger and full meters, which I think probably 70% of us have them broken from industry, and with the current conditions of society, with, you know, constant exposure to necessary decisions that wear down your willpower, and the constant needs of children and spouses, and, you know, different scene changes and explosions and naked people on television, it's not possible to rely on those things entirely. And so I think we need very objective rules, very objective sets of rules and guidelines that are akin to having, you know, stoplights and stop signs and yield signs in a major city, so that there aren't accidents. And if you accept the need for stoplights and stop signs and yield signs, which we do when we drive around Manhattan, for example, otherwise the 11 million people there would be crashing and nobody could get anywhere. When you accept the need for that, you're actually more free as opposed to less free. And you can daydream between stop signs and red lights, and you can call your friends and listen to podcasts and turn on the radio. But I think in the modern world, if you say, well, I'm just going to drive mindfully, I'm not going to worry about the red lights and stop signs and yield signs, I think you're going to crash pretty quickly. So with people who really want to adopt the traditional approach and learn to eat mindfully and eat when they're hungry and stop when they're full, I tell them, can you bear with having some rules, some very objective, externally verifiable rules that are akin to, you know, I'll never have chocolate on a weekday again, or I'll only ever eat bread in a restaurant. Can you have some of those very objective rules to eliminate your decisions until you get to the point that you've got a lot of this junk out of your system, which creates cravings for itself, so that you can start to rely more on your intuitive eating facilities? So I think I might have strayed a little bit from your question, but I think we talked about some important things.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I think it's really important that people realize that there is an element of what is in modern food which is actually leading to these issues. I think it's all too easy to point your finger at the obvious culprits about eating problems, like, oh, social media and whatever. But I think you're one of the main people who I've heard in terms of this who does actually call that out. And obviously, like you said, you did work in that industry, so you know the ins and outs of it. And the other thing about the rules is there seems to be a tendency, and I know you've said this actually before on some of your podcasts, about people saying, you know, if you have any form of restriction, it's going to backfire when someone who has a binging problem applies that. But like you said, it is just like stop signs and go signs and so on. And what I think is really good about what you're saying is that we need to like incorporate these variables in terms of, we need to acknowledge that there's foods that are hyperpalatable and are addictive in a sense, and that we need some like borders around that. Because I think just personally from my experience of what treatment like is here in the UK, they do have this thing about you should have everything in moderation. But I think that maybe for some people, moderation is not a viable solution. And that's why I think maybe they need to think about that. Maybe that for some people, maybe it's better to give them some hard and fast rules that are obviously not depriving them of important nutrients, but are keeping them safe away from those substances, which are obviously not helping with them to manage that side of things. If I'm saying something that's not what you're saying.
No, you're absolutely, you're summarizing what I believe very well. Yeah. So first of all, you can use a rule like a kitchen knife. And you could use a kitchen knife to chop vegetables, or you could use it to murder people. It's just a tool, right? And it's possible to use rules to become overly restrictive. And there's some rules you won't be able to follow. For example, if I made a rule that said I will never pee again, then I could never follow that because my bladder would tell me otherwise, because I have authentic bodily needs that have to be met. So rules are only good in the context of appropriate self-care. And if you use your rules to restrict down to 500 calories a day or, you know, become anorexic in some way, then you're not using the kitchen knife in the right way. There is a function of, there is a reason why many people get better when they have traditional treatment, which says to eat everything in moderation and don't use any rules whatsoever. And the belief there is that any restriction, even a mental restriction, will cause a binge, which I don't believe. But it appears to me most people with eating problems were probably fed against their best interest, not on purpose, but, you know, maybe mom and dad didn't eat so well themselves. Maybe they forced them to eat too much of the wrong things. Maybe food was not available when it should have been. And they needed to become very independent to rebel against that. And so when they are then treated in such a way that they're not supposed to have rules and nobody's going to tell them what to eat at all, they feel like they don't have to rebel against that, and that automatic rebellion is quelled. So that is helpful for a lot of people. However, I think that to take that to the level of saying that we can't have rules or articulate exactly the difference between good and bad food is a mistake. I think that's like treating ourselves like perpetual two-year-olds who are fixated at that developmental level. And I think that there's a higher developmental level that we can strive to, which is, look, nobody can tell me what to eat. I'm going to choose my own rules. And I don't tell anybody what to eat. I cringe at some of the things people do eat. I think we all do. Yeah. We live in a society that tacitly agrees to slowly kill ourselves with food. Mm. But I don't tell anybody what to eat because I recognize that autonomy and struggles with autonomy are a big part of addiction. But if you decide on your own rules, and these can be simple rules, it doesn't even have to do with food to start with. It could just be, I'll always put my fork down between bites, or I'll, you know, never eat in front of a screen again. Or maybe it's, I won't go back for seconds, or I will, you know, I'll never have chocolate again. It could be any of the above. But it's your decision. Then all you're really doing is articulating the way you want to live best anyway. Most people have unwritten rules. If you walk into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table because the last party left the tip and the waitress didn't see it yet, and the waitress goes to get the menu, you're not going to take that $20 bill because you've got an unwritten rule that says, I never steal. I'm not a thief. I never steal. It's just part of your identity. And so all I'm really arguing for is extending your definition of character, extending your definition of who you are by clearly articulating exactly what your rules are. There's one more thing I want. Oh, the last thing I wanted to say is that when intuitive eating works and people eschew all rules and just eat, you know, intuitively, mindfully, and listen to their bodily cues, when it really works for them, they often will come back and tell me they're not eating as healthy as they would like to eat. And I will say, well, of course, because you got to define what you're willing to take in your body or not, because there's flavored cardboard in the food system. You know, go read the book Sugar, Salt, Fat, okay? And go look at, you know, everything that these big companies are doing. There's flavored cardboard in the food system. And it's perfectly legal for the companies to do that. And at some point, if you don't say, this is not food, I won't eat it, then you're just going to wind up eating dog poop.
You're going to end up eating like whatever they're putting out there, because they're actually pretty lax about what can go into food, which is really rather shocking. But like you said, I do think there is a degree that you do need to kind of, and it's not like a restrictive thing. You're honestly just going, no, I'd rather not take that into my body. It's the same decision you'd make with like whether you want to smoke or not, whether you want to do a certain activity or not. You're just defining what you know is right for yourself. And
Yeah.
I think that definitely is something that I think everyone could benefit from it, honestly, not even just people who maybe do have a binging problem. I think everyone can be a bit more like making decisions for themselves about what they do or don't want to put into
I wrote
themselves.
this article for Psychology Today, which points out the disparity in our diagnostic system. 2.8% of the population, depending upon what study you look at, is diagnosable as a binge eater. But 40% of the population is obese to the extent that they're putting their life at risk. There's a problem there, right?
Yeah, definitely.
People are looking and saying, well, I'm not a binge eater. I don't meet those criteria. But even if you're eating beyond your own best judgment, and your health could suffer, or even just your self-esteem is suffering, why not fix it? This doesn't involve taking medication. It doesn't involve any invasive treatment. It involves a thinking game. It involves thinking about your constructive versus destructive thoughts about food in a different way. And you don't have to call it a pig inside of you. You could call it a food monster or a junkyard dog, just not a cute little thing that you want to nurture back to health, something you want to separate from.
Because it is the kind of saboteur almost in your mind. And I know that comes across in like other issues, like especially if you have like self-esteem issues or anxiety, you do have that little voice that is always you're like you know your inner critic. And so almost just being able to decide, no, I'm not going to listen to that is very useful for everyone. Like you said, not everyone falls into the diagnostic criteria for these issues. But like, I think if they get the right guidance, you can stop them from maybe that developing into it.
Yeah.
And I think prevention is always better than a cure, if that's
It's
the
harder
right
to sell,
thing.
though. It's much harder to
It
sell, but
is much
yes.
harder to sell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the thing that is the sometimes the truth or what people need to hear isn't exactly the most palatable, like you said.
Albert Camus said, "The truth is a poor competitor in the marketplace of ideas."
Very, very, very true on a multitude of different levels.
Yeah. But you can use this for positive thinking also. If you define a very specific goal you're trying to accomplish, and then you define any thought that suggests you're not likely to accomplish the goal as a squeal, then you can refute those thoughts just like you can refute thoughts that suggest that you should cross the line and have the chocolate bar.
Yeah, and it's just I think because it's so simple, it's actually almost a bit more approachable than sometimes I feel like when people are talking about like kind of cognitive behavioral therapy and things, it can seem a bit like, well, that's a lot that I have to think about. But if you really think about you're just separating destructive and constructive thoughts, I think that actually makes it a lot easier for people to understand. And I think maybe that's why your approach is really useful for people because it's just simple and they can just get started with themselves. It's
Pretend, make a rule, pretend like you got a pig inside you that wants you to break that rule. Watch for it to try to tell you why you should break it, and then examine how it's lying to you when it suggests that you should break it. That's it.
yeah, very, very simple. But thank you so much for doing the interview. You've given me so many good points. Just as a last thing, if there was something you like, if you could change anything about how, like you said about big food companies, if there was one thing you could change about society in terms of food and eating, like I'm giving you all the power in the world here in the universe, what do you think would be the most beneficial thing, to change about the whole issue of food in society?
Wow. I didn't know I was going to get all the power in the universe. What would I change? I think we need legislation that regulates, the type and amount of palatability enhancers that are allowed in commercial foods. That's what I think. how much sugar can you put in, how many chemicals can you put in. I don't think the regulation is anywhere near in line with the research. And I think that people think they're being protected and they're really not. And I want people to know that if you withdraw from these foods, that your body's ability to derive pleasure from natural foods will be restored. The body's very resilient. Your taste buds should double in sensitivity in a matter of 6 to 8 weeks. Your dopaminergic system should start to respond to subtle differences in flavor between different types of fruits and vegetables or, you know, natural meats. People believe that they have to give up all pleasure, but the truth is that food is more pleasurable when you get these industrial contaminants out of your system. And I would fight for your right to eat the, you know, bags and boxes and containers if you want to. I think we live in a free society, but I simultaneously believe people don't know the price that they're paying, and I think the industry is killing people, so, and making them miserable along the way.
That's very profound what you just said there, like about the industry is literally killing people and completely wrecking them mentally with all of this. And like you said about the kind of taxes on, or like more closely looking at what's going into foods, I also think, just to add to what you said, I do think what you said is excellent, but I also think to add that there should be more accessibility to whole foods for all people, that regardless of socioeconomic background, because I do know that's certainly an issue.
Food deserts are an issue.
Yeah, food deserts, definitely. And I think if you could combine that with stricter rules on what goes into food, I think people would definitely be a lot healthier in terms of what they're eating, and also education about it as well. I mean, no one can deny that education about anything is probably one of the most powerful things you can have. But whether we can make that
silver bullet, yeah.
Yeah, whether we can make that change in the world, in this capitalist world, I'm not sure, but we can sure hope.
Eleanor, when you and I are running things will be different.
Oh yes, can't wait until I run the world and we can abolish all of these awful things that are happening. But anyway, thank you so much for this interview. It's been very insightful, and thank you for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it.
I appreciate it also. If